The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. And as almost never happens, a manager loses his job mid-pod. You'll hear the breaking news in part two, which was recorded before part one, where we will discuss Frank Lampard, as we understand, on his way out of Stamford Bridge. Did he get enough time? Should he have taken the job in the first place? And will Thomas Tuchel, as we expect, get more out of the current squad? Also today, the FA Cup, Manchester United 3, Liverpool 2. What does it mean? United for the double? Will Liverpool ever win again? Fireworks, goal line clearances and long throws at Cheltenham as Manchester City almost slip up. And Wolves are less than convincing against a side whose league has been suspended. We'll do more on the crisis in the National League, discuss Newcastle hiding a Premier League defeat late on a Saturday on an FA Cup weekend, plus your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jacob Steinberg. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm tremendous. Thanks very much. Flo Lloyd-Hughes, nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Max. Hello, hello.
Had you for a couple of cameos recently, but you performed well coming off the bench. Thought we'd give you a start today. Not because it's FA Cup weekend. I'd like to point that out, but it's not a weakened lineup.
Thank you. I think last time I struggled to count to 11, so I'm relieved that despite the count not being able to count to 11, which I think got cut out of the final edit, I managed to still get a callback. So
yeah, congratulations.
Yeah, I was sweating on that one, but I'm relieved.
From the New York Times, Rory Smith. Hi, Rory.
Hello. How are you?
Yeah.
I know the answer to that. Everyone's already answered that. Yeah, you're fine.
And you know, like if deep down I wasn't, I probably wouldn't say.
But this isn't the forum.
No, it isn't. No. Well, we get to that sort of in part three, how you really are. And I've really asking Barry if he's really happy after two pints and he tells him to go away, which is why we never socialise. Okay, everybody, let's start then with the breaking news out of Chelsea, which we will confess happened midway through our discussion, midway through a tortuous analogy of mine about humble pie with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. And you may hear the news breaking in part two. But yeah, from the Telegraph, Frank Lampard set to be sacked by Chelsea less than 24 hours after they beat Luton. Confirmation could come as soon as today after Chelsea players were told not to report to the training ground until this afternoon. This is a developing story, what we're learning and what we understand. Jacob, you're the Guardian's Chelsea correspondent. Your reaction to this news?
My reaction is that today was meant to be a day off. And I generously gave up some time for you guys and then got a message saying that Frank Lampard's been sacked or being sacked. So my reaction is one of frustration and also a lot of surprise. Not because it's obviously been going very well for Frank Lampard over the last couple of weeks, but obviously it's coming in the wake of a fairly comfortable win. You know, fairly comfortable. It was, I didn't think that against Luton on Sunday, yesterday, that they were particularly, great. I mean, I thought that a lot of the, although Lampard talked it up, you know, there were a lot of the problems that have been evident over the last couple of weeks where, you know, they kind of started quite well. Obviously, it being Luton, they got 2-0 up and everything. And then came the complacency that kind of set in and Kepa obviously made the mistake and came back to 2-1. And they were quite lucky to that it didn't go to 2-2 with Kepa actually making a surprising save for him. And although Lampard talked it up, I thought they made a bit of a meal of it in the end. So it wasn't a great performance, but I'm just surprised that it's happening after a win. It's not a surprise overall that it's happened. You know, there'll be a lot of people who think that this should have happened sooner.
Part of me, Rory, thinks sort of on a human level, it's such a shame for Lampard that the job came about when it did and in those circumstances, because had there not been the transfer ban, he probably wouldn't. Maybe he would. I don't know. But you can't say no to that job, but it was too soon for him.
Hubris is probably not the right word, is it? There's an element of, I guess, be careful what you wish for with Lampard, that we don't really know what he's going to be like as a coach. We don't, to be honest, we don't really know whether, you know, he's had the Chelsea job, which I presume to him would have been the pinnacle of club management. He may now decide, actually, do you know what, this isn't for me. I've done my, you know, it's possible he might walk away from it entirely. But we don't really yet have an idea, because he kind of went into Derby, which was a great first job for him to get. It was just about the right level. It's all, you know, we all have these romantic ideas of everyone should start at kind of Billericay Town or whatever. But that's not really, you know, getting experience in League One or League Two is not really relevant to managing a Premier League team anymore. You're much better off actually going to Germany or France and managing a top flight team there. But he did kind of okay at Derby, Lampard. He didn't do a bad job by any stretch of the imagination. He didn't do a kind of eye-catchingly brilliant job. And then he gets the Chelsea offer. And to be honest, this is very much easy for me to say, you wondered at the time whether maybe he needed to think a little bit more carefully about what the potential outcome of that was. Because although Chelsea were talking at the time about kind of a youth revolution and stuff, you knew that that might not hold beyond the season where it had to apply. But then you get Abramovich kind of begging him to take it, really pleading with him, the emotional connection, all that. You can see why he took it. But it maybe is just a little reminder that those jobs need experience. You need to be kind of free to make your mistakes away from the spotlight in a less ruthless environment. There is still a value to working your way up to that kind of level of job. And it's kind of the Guardiola phenomenon, obviously, that's convinced everybody that anyone can do it. So you've got Pirlo going in at Juventus, you've got Arteta at Arsenal. They're all struggling. It's really hard to be even a sort of really bright, really kind of experienced, really talented, really loved ex-player like Frank Lampard at a super club and get it right first time. You're asking for a minor miracle. And as far as I know, it's happened once in history, and that was Guardiola. And basically, there's quite a lot of football clubs out there thinking, well, if he did it, basically anyone can do it. And Zidane did, but Zidane's a that's a whole different kettle of fish. But Zidane's a really weird example because he went into an incredibly talented Real Madrid squad. Florentino Perez was not convinced that Zinedine Zidane was a great manager in waiting. He really wanted. Perez spent ages trying to convince Zidane to take like Marseille so that he could go and fail at Marseille or make his mistakes at Marseille and then come back actually with some idea what he's doing. And then Zidane goes and wins three European Cups in a row. But as we will say in the future about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, in the very near future, it's hard to tell to an extent with Zidane, how much was him and how much is that he created a platform on which the amazing players at his disposal could go and express themselves, which is a skill, but it doesn't make him Pep Guardiola.
Float?
I think there was an important thing that Chelsea had to achieve appointing Lampard, and it was rebuilding a lot of trust with fans, and it did that, but now that's evaporated quite quickly again, because bringing a fan favourite after a lot of short-term managers that brought success, some didn't, and a continuation of this revolving door, fans were frustrated, fans were upset, and bringing back a familiar face who meant so much to the club and meant so much to fans was brilliant. And also one that had to play young players, which was brilliant. You know, so many key players that are now a big part of the England team who really flourished under Lampard. But I think what's disappointing is that it's been so short-lived, because I'm not a massive fan of Lampard. I don't think he really has what it takes yet to be a manager of a Premier League side. And I think he was fast-tracked for various reasons. But I do think the important factor that he brought was that stability and that familiarity to Chelsea that so many fans had missed, because they just felt like they had no connection anymore, because it was just going to be, you know, someone coming in, someone out constantly. And he brought that back. But I just don't know where they go from here in terms of if they bring in a big name like Thomas Tuchel, is that going to build that same kind of rapport and that same connection fast enough before he's out the door again? You know, at least with that familiar face, that they've got that bond. And would it have been better just to sit on Lampard and say, well, the connection with fans is enough? Obviously, there's fans who have been saying he should be sacked and he's not good enough. But there's that connection there that, you know, is having a hometown hero worth the pain if you're giving them enough time and enough love and enough money to get there in the end? I mean, it's the same conundrum with Solskjaer, right? Hometown hero, are we going to back them until it works out rather than just giving them a really short amount of time and then saying, it didn't work, so we're actually going to go someone that makes a lot more sense when we shouldn't have appointed you in the first place.
With Chelsea, I think that's actually something that's the best thing about doing other people's podcasts is that you come on and other really clever people give you ideas of stuff to write about, and then you don't tell them and you don't steal it.
And I know you did that to me before, Rory, when we were in France at the World Cup. So I'm watching you. I'm watching you.
I built my career on Nicky and Flo's ideas, basically. But with Chelsea, you do wonder, like, to go back to Sarri, and I know that it was all dressed up as being about kind of Sarri ball, and they didn't see the point of Jorginho, and they didn't like the way they were playing. But you do wonder, to an extent, whether it was just that kind of seasickness of, like, right, who's this guy? And Sarri didn't have a massive profile in England. He wasn't someone who, I don't know, you'd looked at and had managed Barcelona or Real Madrid or was kind of really famous for doing this, that or the other, won the Champions League. He didn't have the profile of, say, Klopp. When Klopp came to England, everyone had heard of Klopp. It was like, well, who's this Italian man who's had this slightly weird career? And I do wonder whether Tuchel, who I think will be the replacement, might suffer from the same thing, that he's notoriously difficult to work with. He's fallen out with the kind of the higher ups at both of his last two clubs, which is a brilliant recipe for success going into Chelsea. he's kind of like Twitter football famous. Do you know what I mean? Like he's obviously had a really big job at PSG. He did quite a good job at Dortmund. He's a kind of Conoscenti kind of hipster famous manager. He's not like he's won the Champions League famous manager. And I just wonder whether the fans, the bedrock of the fans, might struggle to kind of identify with him a little bit and might, like Flo says, might be a bit like, well, hang on, who's now what? Now we have this German man in charge and this sort of raft of players from Germany and we're going for some sort of German model. When, what, 3 years ago it was Sarri ball, and it must be really hard to be a Chelsea fan and kind of keep up with what the club is trying to do.
Yeah, and they're weird, Jacob, aren't they? They're sort of an outlier in that they do regularly win things, but without... I thought the idea was, you know, Lampard was a project manager. They would change, you know, this idea, win something, sack a manager, don't win something, sack a manager.
Yeah, obviously it worked most famously with in 2012 after sacking Villas-Boas, and that kind of is what people often hang that around, is that they sacked him, brought in Di Matteo as the interim, and they go and win the FA Cup and the Champions League in, you know, fairly fluky circumstances. I'm not sure there's much science behind that. I don't think it was a particularly well thought out thing. It's just, you know, they had to get rid of Villas-Boas because it was going so badly at the time. With Lampard, yeah, he was meant to be a project manager. And as Flo said, you know, there was at the time, it wasn't great around Chelsea. You know, that previous season, the start of 2019, you know, we all remember the chance about Sarri ball, you know, that game against that FA Cup tie against Manchester United at home on a Monday night at Stamford Bridge, where the fans are completely turned. And that's within the context of them, you know, they just landed the transfer ban. Eden Hazard's about to go. It's squad that for two seasons hadn't really been challenging for the title when everybody knows the expectation that at Chelsea. So to bring in, well, for a start with the transfer ban, you know, nobody else apart from Lampard at that stage probably would have wanted to come in at Chelsea. So the Derby County manager at that point made a certain amount of sense, because who else is going to take it? And the Derby County manager happens to be your greatest ever player, give or take Terry and Drogba and Gianfranco Zola. Although there's a split on social media where I think a lot of, from what I can tell of things, is that a lot of Chelsea fans who maybe don't go, who may be watching from afar, have not bought into the Lampard story so much, whereas match-going fans have been much more invested in him. And we saw that yesterday where a fan group called We Are The Shed put up a banner above the top tier of the Shed end yesterday saying, "In Frank we trust," you know, which for me felt a bit ominous given that Wenger had the "In Wenger we trust," "In Arsene we trust" thing at the Emirates for so long, and that didn't really seem to work out and didn't seem to help him at all. They had "In Frank we trust," "Then, now, forever" yesterday at Stamford Bridge, which just showed that for them they really wanted this to work. So the long-term thing was, you know, in one sense you can understand it, but then when they go and spend £220 million last summer, the expectations immediately change at Chelsea. It doesn't matter that these players are, you know, some of them are young, like Kai Havertz and previously the Christian Pulisic as well. That it doesn't matter that they're new to the league. He just had to get it clicking. He had to get it working straight away.
Yes, he was a coursework manager, but he hadn't done any coursework, you know, leaving it all to the last minute. And really, Chelsea is a cramming exam club, isn't it?
Look, he... could well turn out to be a good manager. I think Barney wrote a good piece on in Saturday's Guardian talking about how of the golden generation, he's one of the ones who really gets seems to get a lot more stick than others, probably him and John Terry. It might be because they played in a Chelsea side that wasn't very popular at the time. It rubbed people up the wrong way. And I think there's been a certain playing of the man rather than the bull at times with Lampard. I think he did a good job last season. He didn't do the terrible job that people sometimes like to make out at Derby just because he didn't get them promoted. You know, there are certain things that you can say. He's not stupid. He's obviously a pretty clever guy. I think that he could turn out to be a good manager. But at Chelsea, you just think, why did you take this? It's you probably would have got offered it at some point anyway, down the line, because you are Frank Lampard. And if you had proven yourself and if you'd learnt more, then it might have been there for you later. I mean, a lot of people have said over the last week that, you know, with the inexperience, he doesn't have anything to fall back on. You know, there are a lot of managers who have spent a lot more time, learning based and developing. I mean, look at Dean Smith, who's got Aston Villa playing so well. Look how long he spent in the lower leagues building it up, and Frank Lampard hasn't done that.
Do you think he needed a more experienced manager like Harry Redknapp working alongside
to bring him in? Yeah, maybe he'll be the interim, and you know, he'll be. Frank will be on Goals on Sunday or something, saying, "You know, my uncle's a great football man."
Rory, you mentioned Tuchel because it was interesting. I thought, well, Tuchel seems like a good idea because he's worked with lots of high-profile players and sort of kept them all happy, but he hasn't done that. Forgive my lack of knowledge on this. Like that's the thing with this Chelsea squad: so many good players, you can't pick them all. It's tricky, right?
So I think Tuchel, it makes sense from the profile of the squad. Because obviously he knows Pulisic, he's worked with him before. Havertz, Werner, all kind of brought through that same kind of German pressing school. Tuchel's a little bit more tactically sophisticated than some of the kind of pure high pressers. So I think from Chelsea's point of view, it kind of makes sense. They've obviously kind of, they're now looking at that kind of Bundesliga model as being where they want to kind of put their emphasis, and that's fine, that's up to them. You know, crack on. From that point of view, that kind of makes sense. Tuchel's problem has been managing upwards rather than managing downwards, I think. I don't think the players at PSG particularly adored him, but I don't get the impression that that was ultimately what did for him. I think it was... PSG's a weird squad to manage anyway, but I think it was his relationship with Leonardo, the director of football, that was a problem. And at Dortmund, obviously, there was the falling out with Sven Mislintat, and with that kind of power axis of, like... Michael Zorc and Aki Watzke, that was where the problem was with Tuchel. I think at Chelsea particularly, you have to be really conscious of your place within the hierarchy, and the power balance in that hierarchy changes constantly. It's an awkward, I think it can be an awkward club to work at. And Tuchel's history, his like track record, would not inspire you with confidence that he's the guy to navigate those choppy waters.
There's an amazing dynamic within the club now, which is that... at the same time as Frank Lampard turned up at Chelsea, so did another legend in the summer of 2019, which was Petr Cech, who had just retired from playing. Obviously, he spent the final years of his career at Arsenal. So Petr Cech comes in as technical and performance advisor, and essentially means that he's had a say in the removal of someone who he played with for something like a decade. You know, good friends and... You know, they went and actually were involved together in signing Timo Werner. There was that secret pre-pandemic trip to Germany to chat to him about where he could come into this team and never score again. And
we'll play you off the left, mate.
Yeah, and there you go. It's Petr Cech who is involved in Frank Lampard going. I just find that to be an amazing dynamic. You know, I always thought this is going to be pretty awkward when it comes down to it, because we all know eventually what happens with Chelsea managers is they get sacked in grisly circumstances, but it's never been... Jose Mourinho never had a mate above him that he played with who was sacking him on both of those occasions, did he? This time it's someone that Frank Lampard won. You know, this 2012, they were winning the Champions League together, weren't they? Petr Cech was saving the penalties.
Since they're lifting the trophy together, they can say, one day I'll sack you. Cheers, mate. Yeah.
Lampard was the captain that night, and, you know, there you go. And it's Petr Cech who's done it.
Well, Well, interesting. Quite often when we do the pod, someone gets sacked just after we finish recording. So it's good. It's good timing for us. Unless, of course, they backtrack between the record and when we publish the pod. That would be a disappointment. Anyway, in part two, you'll hear the beginning of the pod. Well, that was what we planned, of the Manchester United Liverpool game, which includes the breaking news that you have already heard about, which is Frank Lampard leaving Chelsea. It sounds like Inception, doesn't it? No one could keep up with Inception, but we'll do that in part two. Let's go to Old Trafford, shall we? Manchester United 3, Liverpool 2. Matt says, I've given up watching United-Liverpool games since, as the pod recently pointed out, they're always dreadful these days. Was this one any good? Rory, was it any good, this football match?
Yeah, it was brilliant. It was really good. It was a really good game. And I think it was a really good game because it wasn't the usual states of United-Liverpool. It was two slightly, not massively weakened teams. They weren't absolute full strength. I think both probably went into it a little bit thinking, if you're ever going to lose a United-Liverpool game, it's possibly this one, because it is, with all due respect, and I know you're not really meant to say it, but only the cup. There was a little bit of a spirit of adventure about it. I thought it was thrilling. I was thrilled.
Were you thrilled, Jacob?
Yeah, it was a very entertaining game, much better than what we saw last week at Anfield. I think that Rory's right in the sense that there was a lot more spirit of adventure. I think that probably, that may even sort of obscure a little bit some of the things that look good at times. I think that Liverpool obviously started very well, and it seemed like they had, United were willing to give them more space than they were at Anfield last week. And it maybe felt a little bit like, you know, they weren't so focused on defending and let's turn this into, you know, a bit of an end-to-end, you score, we score kind of game, which maybe isn't the way that it will be in a really, really important league game. So there may be points at which certain lessons we think we've learned from it maybe aren't that applicable in the league. It might just be one of those games where they've both just gone for it. And I'm not sure, if we look over the course of the season, a lot of these games between the big sides, that's not really been the way of it. It's been very cautious. You know, not just United, Liverpool, all those big games have mainly been like that.
So does that mean that this idea of like the spirit of adventure, which presumably, Flo, is what we want in football matches, Do we therefore sort of write it off because it was in the cup, i.e. it was the spirit of adventure, but it was only the cup? Or do we say, well, we might as well enjoy the cup more than the turgid league games when the big sides play each other? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it's the second one. I think the hype around Super Sunday, especially this season, has been a bit cringe because every single montage has been followed by a pretty boring 0-0 most of the time, or just a dire match altogether. And it's the ones that haven't been hyped so much that end up being the most exciting games. And yeah, the BBC came out with a bit of a cringe sea shanty as part of the build-up, which I will ignore that. But all in all, there wasn't too much hype. There were a few bits and pieces throughout the week, but I think it did deliver. And I think, you know, lots of people have spoken about the impact that the pandemic's having on the quality of football and the lack of fans. And I know Rory did his a brilliant thread on that 3 p.m. kickoff kind of mentality and boredom as well. And I think that's what we're kind of seeing with a lot of those big games, is the more you hype it, the worse it is. And I think there is still some freedom in the cup where, when you've got smaller teams coming into it with nothing to lose, the bigger sides have to match that.
I liked, Rory, how you just nodded in acknowledgement as if it was a brilliant thread.
It was a good thread. No, it was a good point. I make about like one good point a year, and that was one of them.
You're absolutely right. It was one of my greatest threads, absolutely. Anyway, carry on, Rory.
I was going to say, there is, like, generally, I think that the learning culture that we have now in football, where every sort of set of games we all have to learn stuff from them, I think is incredibly damaging and completely vapid. But, and we're all part of that, like I'm as much a part of it as anybody else. But Jacob's right, I think, to an extent, like, we maybe should not, to an extent you can't look at that game and think, right, what pattern does this show us for the rest of the season? Because it was slightly exceptional. It's knockout football for a start. Liverpool kind of went into it, I think, feeling like we just have to score a goal. Whatever happens, we just have to score like one goal. We'll do a goal and then we'll take it from there. United, I thought, played really smartly. I thought Pogba was brilliant. But they would not have been devastated to lose that if they, in the same way as they've been devastated to lose a league game to Liverpool at Old Trafford. But I think the one thing that I really took from that game, the thing that the one single thing I learned, is it kind of encapsulated how fine the margins are, not just between the top teams, but kind of between everything this season especially. So we've already seen that if you can be kind of Premier League champions and have an off day and get smashed by Aston Villa, that just because your press doesn't work, you can concede 7 goals away at Aston Villa. I don't think in recent weeks there's been a vast amount between United and Liverpool's performances. United have won late against Wolves, they've won late against Villa, they've won relatively late against Fulham, they got a point at Anfield, they won relatively late against Liverpool yesterday. Liverpool obviously haven't scored a goal and are in crisis. But it just kind of shows you that basically those two teams were just about as good as each other yesterday. I thought United probably shaded it, deserved it in the end, but there wasn't a vast amount between them. There's not a vast amount between any of them. And the slightest downturn, whether that's an injury or an off day or just a little sort of dip in confidence, can have massive ramifications this season. That was kind of what I thought that game maybe advertised to us.
Bruno Fernandes' free kick decided it. Stephen Howson, who's a presenter, tweeting, "I want to live my life with the optimism of Fred standing over a free kick." It was quite nice. Ian Wright said on telly, Jacob, that it was the substitutes that changed the game. Does that mean Manchester United have more strength and depth than Liverpool? And in which case, how did that happen? Because I'm sure I've spent a lot of time talking about how many millions Man United have spent on nobody.
I think United at the moment definitely have more strength and depth, and that's partly because Jota is out injured and Van Dijk is obviously injured, and I think that I could reel off several other names who are missing from the Liverpool squad at the moment. And then as you go further down it, obviously the quality starts to dip. There have been some of those signings that Liverpool have made over the last couple of years where, you know, we've made a lot of play about how good their recruitment has been, and a lot of it certainly has been. We don't need to name them all, but there are certain ones which haven't really come off. You know, it's been quite a long time now since Minamino turned up at Anfield, and he hasn't really done anything. You know, he looked like a very smart signing when it happened, but nothing's really worked for him since then. You know, Naby Keita is somebody who they bought for 17 million, I think, something like that. And, you know, he's been largely disappointing in the 2.5 years since he arrived in England. So there are points in Liverpool's squad where it's not quite worked. They've lost, obviously, they lost their fourth choice centre-back, Lovren, and they didn't replace him, sort of went in with that gamble. And that's been shown up to be a bit of a mistake. And the fact that they haven't even identified that over the, you know, coming into the January window, you know, again, maybe trying to be a little bit too smart. That's, you know, that's kind of hurt the squad, hasn't it? It's had the impact not only on the defence, but further up the team. It looks like, you know, both in midfield and the front line, it's not quite clicking in the same way, because they really were a machine, Liverpool, weren't they? Where everything it felt like had to work in perfect harmony. Whereas United, you kind of feel like at times they are able to produce those individual moments to win games, because there are so many match winners in that side. So yeah, you know, that there are at the moment, I would definitely say that United have, you know, they don't have that many injuries, so definitely they have more strength and depth than Liverpool at the moment. And I think that they are really struggling because of because you know some of those signings haven't quite come off, and obviously the lack of cover in central defence, because you know Reece Williams may well end up turning into a very good defender, but yesterday you could tell against that top level of striker he's going to make a couple of mistakes and it's going to prove fatal.
There's an element of resources about it. I think that United, for all like you say, Matt, have been criticised for their kind of ability to waste money in the transfer market. They have continued to kind of just reinforce their squad, and ultimately, not, there's probably quite a lot of players there who you look at and think they've not been the success we thought they'd be, but they're still really good players. And it's been obvious the last few weeks, I think, that when United rotate, they're rotating from a position of strength. So you know, you can bring in Edinson Cavani as your backup striker. That's not bad going. That's pretty good. He's quite a good footballer, Edinson Cavani. And I think, like Jacob says, that Liverpool have got. There's two things that have kind of counted against Liverpool, and again, it comes down to that fine margin thing, that if Liverpool have Van Dijk, Gomez, Keita, Jota fit, and kind of Oxlade-Chamberlain and a couple of others not just coming back from injury, that side's probably stronger yesterday. If United have a couple of injuries, their side's probably weaker, and it's that's enough to turn the season away from one big team and towards another. On the recruitment of the central defender, Liverpool have had a lot of praise. They've probably not had as much scrutiny with a few of the signings that as is warranted. Minamino and Keita are probably the best two examples. But the other thing is the dogmatism. They've obviously decided, I don't think it's to do with money not being available to Klopp. I think it's the club's principle and its policy is if we can't get the exact player we want, then we're not going to sign anybody. And that has worked for them brilliantly. I think they intend to sign a central defender in the summer. I think that central defender is probably someone they'll play against in the Champions League last 16, and I don't think it's Diot or Upamecano. And they've obviously decided that is what they're going to do. That sort of dogmatic, kind of fundamentalist approach to this is the way we do things and we will not deviate, it's great while everything's going swimmingly. But when you've got like an actual situation where two of your three central defenders are not fit and the other one is a little bit unreliable physically, you probably just need to say, we need to go and sign somebody. And fans generally, all of us, journalists in particular, kind of look at the transfer market as a way to solve problems far too quickly, far too easily now. But there are certain situations where you kind of look at it and think, well, actually, this is quite simple. You have to go and sign somebody else to cover for the two people who can't play football anymore. And the fact that Liverpool haven't done that is not necessarily a surrender of the title, but it's almost an acquiescence to the fact that they can't win anything this season, I think.
I know last time I think I was on for a full 90 minutes appearance, I kind of joked about, you know, Liverpool should have just bought kind of a past it 30-year-old as a filler. And I know a couple of Liverpool fans were a bit cheesed off because of the very point that Rory's just made is every single piece of the jigsaw has to fit and has to work, because if it doesn't, that, you know, there's no point. But I do think it's naive to think that in a season like they were going to have with COVID and the pressure of games, that these things weren't going to happen, that the squad wasn't at risk of potentially facing a lot of injuries. So I'm surprised that they're not eyeing the January window as finding someone to come back and fill and become a squad player, because it just doesn't make sense to me to continue, especially with Williams, who just doesn't have the experience. Even if he's part of that Liverpool philosophy and it's in his identity, he just isn't good enough. And why would you, I don't know, why would you continue to force that when you're coming off being champions and having an incredible season? The FA Cup in recent years hasn't been Liverpool's competition anyway. So perhaps that was almost inevitable that they weren't going to go that deep into it. But to struggle like they have in the league is concerning, and I don't understand why they wouldn't want to try and fix that.
On the other side, with Solskjaer, if you look at, you know, Luke Shaw's turnaround and how well he's playing, you look at sort of McTominay's improvement, how well Pogba's doing. I wonder, Jacob, like, should we be like preheating the oven for the Ole humble pie? Like, should it be put in the oven? Should I be eating it already? I don't want to eat humble pie if I have to regurgitate it. But like,
breaking news from the Telegraph, Frank Lampard's being sacked.
Oh, wow. Right. So, I keep this in. This is exciting. So look.
Changes my morning. I was meant to have a nice relaxing morning. It's Monday. I've got admin to do.
No more humble pie, Max. What kind of pie are you eating now?
So Jacob, on Solskjaer's humble pie, where should we be at? Where should I be at with Solskjaer's humble pie?
be pretty careful, given you know, get sacked tomorrow. So, you know, now we know this.
The thing about the humble pie and Solskjaer is that it's really hard to tell with United how much of it is Solskjaer being a managerial genius that everybody missed, including loads of Man United fans for the last 2 years, and how much of it is the fact that he's got a load of really good footballers at his football team and at his disposal. But the thing that I think he has to get a huge amount of credit for is he does seem to have found a kind of platform that works for his squad, which is what Mourinho struggled with, which is what Van Gaal struggled with, which is what Moyes struggled with. That they've got this kind of disparate set of players who don't necessarily kind of add up into a team. There's no obvious, like, this is the obvious thing we're going to do. There's no overarching vision. And Solskjaer's kind of found a way to make it work. And I think that is a really important skill in elite club management. So he deserves a huge amount of credit for that, but that does not necessarily turn him into Rinus Michels.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on that, because I think there's a lot that Solskjaer has shown in his ability about man management, especially, you know, not throwing players under the bus, managing difficult situations, especially the one with Pogba's agent, managing those situations really well. And when you look at how Jose Mourinho managed Luke Shaw and what that player had to suffer with, also on, you know, from fans as well, like, you know, people commenting on his size and his weight and everything. And I was thinking about this last night, thinking, you know, that's really hard to deal with for anyone, even if you're not in the public eye. Like, it's a really tough thing to struggle with. And to now be playing like he is, especially yesterday, I thought Luke Shaw was exceptional yesterday, I think Solskjaer can take a lot of credit for that, because he has got the best out of a lot of players that were struggling when he took over. But I agree with Rory that I don't think it covers some of his other inexperiences, and I think, yes, he is blessed with a really good squad, but I still think he lacks some of that coaching ability. And I think he's on a good run now. I think he uses substitutes well. I think that's another kind of string he has to his bow, but I do think he's kind of lacking that experience to know, right, you know, when things are going wrong, this is what I've got to do. I think we talked about those late wins that he's been able to secure, and I don't know if a lot of them have been down to any particular bit of tactical genius from Solskjaer and more, I've got big players who will pull out big things in key moments, or, you know, good substitutions from him, but not necessarily, right, I've got to change the shape, I've got to do this. I'm yet to kind of have that humble pie-ness to it, but, you know, could United go a whole season sort of winging it? Potentially. I don't think they'll win the league. I think City will, but I'm impressed with Solskjaer. I think he is proving a lot of people wrong.
From Manchester United to Manchester City, who won 3-1 at Cheltenham. This was the closest to the magic of the cup, wasn't it? Long throws, fireworks, stopping the game. Amazing. That goal line clearance, Rory, from Ben Tozer was ludicrous, wasn't it?
Yeah, but that's what the cup's about. That's what you want in the cup. It's kind of the fact that I had loads of messages from people who have no interest in either Cheltenham or Manchester City telling me about Ben Tozer, who I'd never previously heard of on Saturday. And then Alfie May scoring the goal. Like, it still provides the moments in which those players who never otherwise have a kind of moment in the sun can shine and look fantastic and play brilliantly, and, you know, for long periods looked like they were at least sort of casting a bit of doubt in Man City's minds, this sort of all-conquering Man City team that was obviously weakened, but it was relatively strong. You know, they had a load of internationals on the pitch. They, you know, Phil Foden, the best English player of his generation, probably. Gabriel Jesus, you know, all these semi-superstars. And they're getting held at the Johnny Rocks. There's a real issue with lower league stadium names that is not being spoken about enough. There's the Johnny Rocks in Cheltenham. That's not a sensible name for a stadium. You can't take that seriously. There's the Wham Stadium in Accrington, named, I think, after the band. And you kind of... people need to kind of think that these are not proper stadium names. It's unacceptable. But no, Cheltenham was fantastic. And I think that, even in defeat, there is still a degree of magic of the cup in that situation.
I'm a big fan of Rotherham Stadium being called the New York Stadium, which I presume is just, you know, like just trying to hoodwink the odd tourist
I believe sponsored by the city of New York as part of their tourist outreach, but not enough tourists going to New York from South Yorkshire. So they've sponsored it. But that, at least that's like a proper, I mean, the Whams, Accrington are a great club, and they do, John Coleman's a brilliant manager and Andy Holt's a lovely fella, but the Wham Stadium, come on, that's not.
Is it not named after the you know, that sort of, the suite, the sort of very sticky bar that you could never get the whole wrapper off?
It could be, but right. I believe it's the band.
On the, sorry to change the subject back to the Cheltenham City game, Rory. On the long throw subject, Pep said, unfortunately, in the Tony Pulis era at Stoke City, I was not here, but I heard a lot of stories from my staff about this weapon, which sounds really quite rude about Tony Pulis, but he was talking about the throw in itself. There's something, Flo, that I love about, you know, the elite of the elite. These are the best footballers, give or take, in the world, all having to just deal with a long, flat grenade being launched underneath the crossbar at the near post. You know, it doesn't matter what you learn in training, you just have to be there. Like, it is miserable at any level of football having to defend that throw-in.
Yeah, and I think it's actually, I mean, Pep may be wishing that Pulis was still around at Stoke and launching those grenades, because perhaps they would have a bit more experience at defending them. But I do think, because you don't really see that so much in the Premier League, you do see it in the Championship and League One, League Two, especially because a lot of clubs do have still, you know, those sorts of long throw specialists in their ranks. Because you don't see it in the Premier League, they're not really used to defending those sorts of things. So it's funny sort of watching their reaction to it, and it does become a little bit of a sort of pinball, bodies flying, and it paid off. So it was a great little tactic from Cheltenham to do that. And I kind of agree with Rory that certainly for Tozer afterwards, he was saying that, you know, regardless of the score, it was an amazing evening, and the club and the players and the fans, you know, enjoyed every minute of it. So they weren't really focusing too much on the defeat. But I hate those sorts of long essays that people write about, you know, is the magic of the cup dead and stuff. Like, let's stop focusing on the magic and just kind of, you know, what is this magic? Is it some kind of pixie that comes and decides whether or not the cup is going to be fun? I think, you know, it's nice seeing these stories and seeing fans and clubs get to enjoy, you know, their moment in the sun, I guess.
I've enjoyed doing the phone-in. Has the phone-in, has the magic of the FA Cup lost its magic, lost its magic? And, you know, I would happily put a ban on people talking about when the FA Cup final coverage used to start really early and Gerald Sinstad would be on a bus. I think we all know that happened. Jacob, what did you think at the end? Phil Foden put his arm around Alfie May and said, look, you know, well done. You're a great player. And Alfie May's 27 and Phil Foden's 20. Was that a nice touch given how great Foden is? I'm just wondering, is it, you know, I'm sure there are podcasters who are better than me, but like, if a 20-year-old podcaster, after I guested on their pod, put their arm around me and said, you were really good today, I would find it slightly patronising.
What would you do?
Well, obviously, I'd swap my Jardigan for their Jardigan, you know, and hang it up in my downstairs toilet.
You wouldn't, would you hold it against them for forever?
Yeah, probably.
It's a small industry, isn't it? So, you know.
Yeah, you're right. You've got to be kind to those people. You never know. When, a bit like Petr Cech, that younger podcast will be sacking me. It'll be very upsetting. Maybe it wasn't. Anyway.
I don't know. I mean, Foden's going to be such a great player. Maybe it's something for Alfie May to tell the grandkids, as they say.
Who are probably older than Phil Foden. That's the point I was trying to make.
Yeah. It just shows the confidence of the kid, doesn't it?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Jeff. Wolves won at Chorley 1-0. First ever goal for Vitinha. Jamie Vermiglio, the Chorley manager, said, if you're going to lose, I'd prefer to lose to a goal like that than a scruffy goal. It was a good hit. I'm proud of what we've done for our community. My kids at school will remember that their head teacher got this far in the FA Cup. Hopefully it can inspire some of them.
I mean, they probably won't remember because they're, what, six now, so they'll probably forget it. But, I mean, it's nice. It's nice.
And they're learning online anyway. It's hard to remember
exactly.
Anything on a Zoom call.
They've
made up to $500,000 in earnings from the cup run. They've got people who are isolating those players, have given them a little bit of happiness. Am I reading too much into it, Rory? But like, a decent Wolves side barely beat a side from the sixth tier. We'll go into what's happening with the National League North a bit later, but it's not quite working for Wolves, is it?
The Premier League team in that situation can't win, whatever the score is. Just even if they win 10-0, people just go, well, you should score 10, it's Chorley. So to an extent, I'm not inclined to actually kind of read anything at all into
it. What have you learned, though, Rory? Did you learn from the game?
I learned nothing from that game, other than that Vitinha can kick the ball quite hard. And I don't think there's any reason to kind of... You can't read anything into the performance because it's such an unusual situation. But more broadly, Wolves are not having a great time of it. They are kind of, they feel a little bit like they're drifting, which is really alien to a club that seemed so clear in its identity, so clear in its plan for so long. It does feel a little bit as though this is the season where Wolves have just kind of crunched a little bit. And I think partly that's obviously the Raul Jimenez injury. Partly it's the fact they've always had a really small squad and Nuno wants a small squad and this is not the year to have a small squad. And partly I wonder if it's just a little bit of a sort of slight stasis, slight stagnancy set in after 3 years where they've really established themselves. But this, you know, beating Chorley in the cup, there was no outcome in that game in which Wolves could have emerged with any credit. There just isn't. It's the
100-0.
No, even then, to be honest, the best score in a game like that you can probably manage is Spurs score 5 at Marine. Was that right?
Right, okay. Yeah, 4-0 at half, 4-0 at halftime, 5-0 at full time. That's what you want.
That is the only scoreline in which you might get some sort of credit. But even then, all you'll get is, well, they should be doing that. You know, they're a non-league team.
Southampton 1, Arsenal 0. I enjoyed Martin Keown on Gabriel's own goal saying, take nothing away from the finish. He was probably referring to Kyle Walker-Peters when he thought it was a shot when it was a cross. Martin Ødegaard, is that a good idea, anybody?
I don't know enough about Martin Ødegaard, but I do think that Arsenal have obviously lacked a lot of creativity this season. It's been a big issue for them. Obviously, there's been the Ozil issue, which is, on the one hand, I can, you know, you understand why Arteta didn't want, you know, he wants a sort of pressing style. People who are working hard for the ball, you can understand why he doesn't want somebody who kind of strolls around at times and doesn't really close anybody down when Arsenal don't have possession. On the other hand, it is something that did leave them unable to break down defences, which is what we saw in those terrible games earlier on in the season. So somebody who could potentially come in and help them with that does make a certain amount of sense, even though, you know, there is that sort of immediate jump to sort of go, oh, look at Arsenal signing another creative infielder as if they need another one of those.
Thierry Small came on to be Everton's youngest ever player yesterday in their win over Sheffield Wednesday. 16 years and 176 days, born on the 1st of August 2004. Would you like to know what was number one in the charts?
2004, when August?
Yeah. August, yeah. Were you born, Flo?
Yeah.
Good.
I was, but I was in the last year of primary school. So,
oh,
you know,
God. Oh,
I was
Jesus.
Just, I was like the Chorley manager's, you know, school children. 2004.
Was it Last Ketchup?
It wasn't Last Ketchup. Arguably, probably a bit more sort of musical gravitas.
Jennifer Lopez.
Scott Parker's my clue.
The Streets.
It was The Streets. Dry Your Eyes. Rattling through the rest of the FA Cup, the rest of it was sort of ticked along, didn't it? Leicester won 3-1 at Brentford, 4-4 for Madison, and 6 goal involvements in the last 5. That's an annoying stat, but he's a wonderful player. His feet were so quick to set up Cengizunda, weren't they? Burnley beat Fulham. Yves Bissouma scored a lovely goal. Ryan Brewster can't score for Sheffield United. West Ham hammered Doncaster. I saw Millwall's sponsor is Husky Chocolate, which I enjoyed a lot. They lost 3-0 to Bristol City. Right, so tonight Wickham play Spurs. Bournemouth Crawley's on Tuesday. We'll talk about those on Wednesday's pod. The fifth round games to be played on the weekend of the 10th, 11th of February. That'll do for part two. Part three, you may not have noticed Newcastle lost again in the Premier League. We'll ask some generic cut and paste Steve Bruce-based questions in a second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Villa 2, Newcastle 0. The weekend that Rafa Benitez leaves Daily and Professional, 12 million a year. 12 million a year is extraordinary. Newcastle are really boring, Flo, aren't they? I mean, it's interesting. There's a question from Paul here saying, is it a myth that pundits won't hear a word against their mates? The refusal to criticise Steve Bruce is quite amazing at times. We haven't scored a goal from open play in over 15 hours. And still the problem is that Newcastle fans demand too much.
I think when you watch Match Today, Alan Shearer is pretty critical of them. But I think the Sky pundits maybe not. I mean, I have to say, I don't watch a lot of Newcastle for 90 minutes. But I do think, it, you know, looking at the fan reaction and looking at tweets from journalists that do cover Newcastle, they're pretty boring and rubbish to watch. And I think judging by Bruce's post-match comments where he's kind of clinging to excuses that Ryan Fraser and Sam Maximan haven't played in the same side yet all season and that could be a game changer, I think is kind of clutching at straws. So yeah, it's looking more and more likely that, you know, Benitez could come back. But I guess the issue before with Benitez was investment and not getting that backing. And now that money has been spent and Ashley has kind of got his wallet out and bought a few players, attacking-minded players, but aren't necessarily being used the right way, then is he then going to give Benitez more money to spend? I'm not so sure. So isn't it just going to be a repeat of the same issue and frustrations that Benitez had before? So will he want to go back into that environment?
No,
Benitez did a fantastic job.
He can't.
But why would he want to do that? Because I don't think he's going to get that much money to spend, because Bruce has been given quite a lot, to be fair, and he's not really making the most of it. And I think the long COVID situation with Saint-Maximin is a massive loss. And he came on, I think, played 20 minutes yesterday. And he's working his way back, fingers crossed, to full fitness. But apart from that, you know, some of those signings haven't paid off. And I don't think Saint-Maximin's going to just revolutionise things. Neither is Ryan Fraser when they're fully fit.
Any thoughts, Rory?
I'd be surprised if Rafa was of the view that he could go back to Newcastle. I think he'll want another job in England. He will set his sights slightly higher than where he realistically might be in the market. I think, I don't want to sound horrible, but I suspect that he will believe his level is a higher club than he might realistically get a job in. To be honest, I don't really see that there is a job for him in the Premier League in the near future. Particularly, I'm not quite sure that any of the clubs that you think might be kind of Benitez-style jobs are likely to come up. David Moyes has done a brilliant job at West Ham. That's normally the one that you think, well, that's the job Benitez will eventually get. He will eventually be West Ham manager. But David Moyes is doing fantastically. I don't see him going back to Newcastle. And I don't really see where Newcastle don't. I'm actually going to St James's tomorrow, Tuesday, because they're playing Leeds. And I think there's a really kind of interesting contrast between Newcastle and Leeds, who in terms of points aren't having that different. Their seasons aren't that different. I think Leeds have got 23 and Newcastle have got 19. There's maybe one win in it. But in terms of the kind of the mood around the club, the sense of ambition, the sense of having a place that you're going, of standing for a thing, of being something that the fans can be proud of, they're at opposite ends of the table, effectively. Newcastle, the idea that Newcastle fans are incredibly demanding is one that should be retired along with a lot of the sports journalists who regurgitate it, because it's not true. It might have been true in the late 1990s, but it is not true now. Newcastle fans want a decent team to watch, which is true of literally all football fans. Literally all fans want a decent football team to watch. They don't want to win a trophy, particularly. They just want a club that tries. They want their club to mean something. I think Newcastle fans might be the least demanding fans in Britain, in a way, if that's not like patronising and making them sound like simpletons. Don't mean it like that. But they just want their club to have a go and not to be locked in some sort of horrible stasis that is never going to lift.
Stephen says, can anyone summarise the situation in the National League and the National League North and South now? Flo, I sort of forced this upon you. My understanding is that they were given a grant by the DCMS at the start of the season, and they were under the impression that the next amount of money, that was about 10 million, the next amount of money would also be a grant. And the DCMS have said it's a loan. The clubs are saying we can't afford to repay any loan. Is it, which is my view, there's no one in the government who likes football, which is not necessarily a crime. Lots of people don't like football, but if there's no one there banging the drum, it's why they give £1 billion to the arts. I also like the arts, to not carry on, and yet won't give another 10 million to non-league football that is carrying on. Am I right or wrong?
Yeah, so there's definitely several layers to it. But yes, the DCMS is part of the kind of emergency grants to a lot of sports, of which some sports got a lot more than others, rugby union. There was initial 11 million that was given to National League clubs that was a grant, and there was a lot of controversy about how it was distributed, and the National League board is under scrutiny because of that, because a large proportion, about 60% of the funding, was given to the top tier National League. So some clubs were getting 95 grand a month and other clubs getting 84 grand a month. But then in the North and South, it dropped all the way down to 36 grand and 30 grand a month. And it wasn't based on gate receipts loss. And the understanding from the clubs and from the Secretary of State for Sport, Oliver Dowden, I think in either committee hearing or in the House of Commons, said that the money was going to be based on gate receipts. So all the clubs had kind of budgeted for what they thought was going to be some money based on gate receipts. Now, the National League handed out this money not based on gate receipts, and it meant the top tier got an inflated amount of money when you've got clubs like Dulwich, York City, Chester, who actually get bigger attendances than some clubs in the top tier National League. So that was kind of the first bit of controversy. That was the first 10 million. What's left is 11 million. And there was the understanding that that was going to be a grant again. Now, DCMFs have turned around and said that's going to be a loan. And National League, like you said, have said, I'm pretty sure it's a grant. It's now left on basically Sport England to decide what they're going to do and maybe find some kind of paper trail. I don't know. And I think there's going to be a meeting this week about what happens. But it's just caused a lot of disruption because I think based on that first sort of handout and how that was done. And also there's a report that David Bernstein, the former chairman of the FA, put together, I think just before Christmas, investigating the handling of that and some other issues since the National League kind of went on suspension last season. And that report is still yet to be released. So clubs are frustrated because they want to see the contents of that report. There's a lot of pressure on the National League board. Their CEO left at the end of last year. There's lots of pressure on Brian Barwick, a familiar face within the sports world, to resign as a result of this. National League North and South are suspended currently for 2 weeks. So they want some kind of assurances about this money, and they want assurances about COVID testing because the leagues can't continue without COVID testing because, you know, most of these guys, a lot of them have part-time jobs, so they need to know that they're not going to put their families at risk or their colleagues at risk. And also, they can't take the time off. So if the clubs don't have the money to pay for flights to games or quick travel to games or a hotel. So, sorry, lots of clubs are looking for reassurances basically about how the season's going to finish, if it's going to finish, because I think for a lot of them, they would rather null and void the season rather than taking out some kind of loan that they don't know if they can afford to pay back or putting their players and their families in danger. So it's a mess is what I would say, but hopefully there's going to be some clarity this week.
Now, we should say that in response to the claims made by the National League, a DCMS spokesperson told the BBC it is untrue to suggest funding to the National League was ever promised as all grants, and they have been unable to substantiate this claim. They also state that if any individual Step 1 or Step 2 National League club can demonstrate it is in critical need of support and would be unable to repay a loan, grant applications will be assessed on a case-by-case basis. A question from Torp. And Rory, it sort of leans a little bit on your excellent Twitter thread of a while back that you've acknowledged was excellent. Has anyone fallen out of love with football during the pandemic? I can't watch it anymore. I follow it vicariously through the musings of Barry, Max and everyone else. And I don't know if your thread was about falling out of love with football, but it was sort of similar in that losing those Premier League games at 3 o'clock on a Saturday has a real knock-on effect for lots of people's enjoyment of the game.
Are you sure you're reading that message right? Is it not that they're falling out of love with football because they're listening to you? Is that not
well?
What
I mean, that's highly possible. this is when people want to, you know, we're like a sort of Nicorette patch for football, right? If you if you like football but you really don't want to like it, you then listen to this for a while, and like within a year or two, you don't want anything to do with the game anymore.
You're a football methadone. It's fine.
Yeah.
It just struck me over. It's not a particularly. It wasn't. It was very nice of Flo to say it was a good thread, but I don't think it was particularly original thought. But it just struck me over Christmas and New Year that the one thing that we've really lost is that sense of the week building to this period on a Saturday afternoon between 12:30 and Final Score or Sports Report or whichever of those things you want to watch. Where there's lots of games that you might not be invested in emotionally, but you want to know what's happening. And that is what I think to a lot of fans, match day is that sense that wherever you are on a Saturday afternoon, whether you're at a game or whether you're shopping or playing with your kids or whatever you're doing or working, you know that there are 4, 5, 6, 7 games going on at that point that might not involve your team, that you might not want to watch, but that give you this sense that there is something happening that you want to kind of keep up
be
with.
Part so think, of, yeah.
Yeah, like, I think a lot of people would kind of go out on a Saturday afternoon or spend the Saturday afternoon doing whatever they happen to do on Saturday afternoon, but then be back in front of the telly for, like, what, 20 to 5 to watch Final Score or Soccer Saturday or BT Sports Score or whichever one you're watching, or turn the radio on.
All good Saturday afternoon score reports are available, as Rory's just lit it off.
Just trying to be even-handed. But like,
Around the Grounds with Adrian Durham is what I would listen to. But
yeah, absolutely. The is it? The Final Score is probably the one that most people tune into. Like, that's the, you put the TV on and you just want to see what the scores are. So I'm not a Cambridge fan, but you sit and watch and find out what Cambridge's score is, because you watch all of the scores. That's why, like, James Alexander Gordon was such a big part of British cultural life. This man who read out a list of places was kind of someone that we
and all numbers, to be fair to him. Places and numbers, yeah.
It's why it was such a big deal when Charlotte Green got that job, because it's a really important thing to us. And it's an important thing because it rounds off that sense of Saturday as match day. And I think I get why the Premier League have gone for this model where every game has its own TV slot and everything has to be broadcast. But I think it costs us that idea of match day. And it also, it misses the fact that one of the ways that we consume football is by not watching football, that we don't need to watch all of the football. Very few fans feel this compulsion to watch every game. And if people are finding that they're not feeling like they're not watching as much football as they used to, I wonder how much of that's an illusion, that you are actually watching as much as you used to. You're just not watching as much as is available.
Sure. And actually, there's an interesting point here, because like half the pod audience is overseas,
yeah,
right? And they can, most places in the world can watch every single game.
Well, no, you can't, because a lot of the games are simultaneous.
At the same time. No, I take that point. But they find that strange. And I do wonder, because I've loved the iFollow, right? I've loved having Cambridge United on iFollow. And when the pandemic is done, I will be playing football on a Saturday, so I won't be able to watch them every single week, but I will still watch their midweek game. You know, I would watch more if that continued. And there's always been a debate about, should you have a way of every Premier League game being available, because it would stop lower league fans going. And I'm really torn now, because I'm a lower league fan who doesn't live where my team is, who wants to watch them. And I would love to have that option, but I can't write that option off at Premier League level to say, oh, you can't, you know, that sort of 3 p.m. blackout. I don't know if it's possible to have all the games available, but have at least 5 or 6 of them at 3 p.m. on a Saturday. I wouldn't necessarily have a problem with that. Final question before you're all allowed to leave. What current Premier League manager, to really play into the zeitgeist of the fact it's been snowing this weekend, what Premier League manager would be best in a snowball fight? Needs a combination of agility and throwing power. Now, the answer to every question about this is always Sean Dyche. But
agility, though.
Yeah.
Rodgers.
So I don't know. He'd have the power.
Hasenhüttl, given where he's from as well.
That's true.
True. Is he nimble enough on his feet?
I mean, Arteta's... how old is Arteta?
Arteta's not getting involved in a snowball fight. He'd be immaculately dressed. He wouldn't want to... Arteta wouldn't like it when you get a drip down your neck. I'm going Brendan Rodgers.
Thomas Tuchel? Or is he not in yet?
Would argue with all the people on his team.
Oh, I see. Do you play proper team snowball fight? That's taking tactics to a new level.
I'm big into snowball fights.
Oh, I thought so. Fight. Okay. What formation do you play? I'll save that for Wilson next time he's on. Look, thanks so much, everybody, for your time and for dealing with the breaking news. Jacob, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Enjoy the rest of your day off.
I don't think so.
Flo, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Max.
Cheers, Rory.
Bye.
We're back on Wednesday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.